Hello and welcome to another episode of Rational Actors on Blogging Heads. I'm Kevin Glass and I'm the managing editor at Town Hall, and today I'm joined by...
Hey, I'm Samantha Lackman and I'm a staff reporter at the Huffington Post Bureau in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, thanks for being with me, Samantha. We wanted to give kind of a rundown on the upcoming midterm elections, almost in a kind of, cable newsy, sportsy type way. We're going to pick races to watch and upset picks. So with that in mind, I wanted to have you introduce the first race that you think is going to be one of the more important ones.
Sure. Well, a race that I'm particularly obsessed with, although there are many, is in Colorado, where Senator Mark Udall, who was elected in 2008, is facing off against Representative Cory Gardner, who represents a district around Yuma, a little bit more of a conservative district in the state. And Gardner has been posing a really strong challenge to Udall so far. He's been consistently leading in the polls, a string of nonpartisan polls. The latest had him up by 7 points, I think it was. And so really this race is going to test, you know, what is the Democratic turnout game look like in Colorado? How does the all-male voting system, every registered voter gets their ballot mailed to them, to their home or apartment, whatever it is. How does that affect the race and sort of what the national climate is in Colorado? And so that's one that I have been watching very closely and that I think everyone else should too.
The everyone gets a ballot provision, that's really interesting to me, and I followed it a little bit. If I'm not mistaken, this is the first year where that's in effect, right?
Yeah, I mean, at large portions of the state, different counties have actually been, you know, doing very consistently have been doing all-male elections, but this is the first one where you don't even have to be an active voter. Like, you could have not voted in 2012, but voted in 2010, and you'll get your ballot mailed to you. And so it's pretty comprehensive across the board. It doesn't mean that you have to vote by mail. Like, they have same-day registration on election day, so you could show up at a polling place on November 4th and register to vote and vote on November 4th in person, and you can also do that during early voting. But it seems like it's going to be like 70 to 80% of people, if not more, are going to vote by mail this year.
Yeah, that's really interesting to me. I mean, it's a experiment that I don't think we've seen in the United States before, and really could affect, you know, how a lot of these polling models are working. You know, I have both Huffington Post's poll tracker and Town Hall's poll tracker, which is more of a polls only model, up before me, and Gardner's up by 3 in the Huffington Post model. He's up by 2 in Town Hall's poll tracker. But a lot of the surveys, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, a lot of the polling and the surveys rely on what's called likely voters, which is self-identified voters. And, you know, if a pollster calls you up and says, are you a likely voter? And you say, you know, I'm not planning on going to the polls on election day, I wouldn't call myself a likely voter. And then you get a ballot in the mail. That makes it a lot easier to vote. It might throw a lot of these polls into kind of disarray here. So I'm not sure, you know, how that's going to affect it. And again, momentum and energy is really important in midterm elections. And usually Republicans, in at least the last few cycles, have a major advantage in what we call a structural advantage in midterm elections, mm-hmm. because the bases are a lot more, or the Republican base is a lot more excited and enthusiastic to vote in midterm elections than they are in, or comparatively with general elections. So, you know, if vote by mail, if the universal ballot thing really causes the people who aren't excited to actually vote, and we would say, you know, the people who quote unquote aren't excited do lean a little more to the left, that could throw a wrench into all of these models here.
Yeah, absolutely. If you have your ballot sitting on your kitchen and it's October, you know, 27th or 28th, and you're procrastinating from going to work or going to school, and you're like, "Hey, I'll just fill it out." You know, it kind of throws a lot of uncertainty into the race. And all the operatives that I've seen discussing it in stories, and I was in Colorado reporting last week, have said that it's kind of the X factor. Is they're not exactly sure how it's going to affect things. But then again, the campaigns can track who's voted, and so I was talking to voters in Colorado who were like, "Oh my god, I have to get it in so they'll stop bothering me," because they can track and see. They can't see how they voted, but they can see that a particular person did send their ballot in once it's been received. And so,
oh, the campaigns
we'll start to know.
So the campaigns themselves can see who has sent in a ballot.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so, yeah, in the next, I think in the next week and the few days leading up to Election Day, they're going to be focusing on those registered Democrats, if they're the Udall campaign and the other campaigns in the state, like Hickenlooper's, or on the other side, they'll be, you know, particularly targeting those voters who are registered but haven't sent their ballot back in. And so the micro-targeting is pretty sophisticated. And then the other thing, just to go off of that, is that there have been some stories about how these polls seriously underestimate Latino voters because they're only polling in English. And so there's a lot of voters who may not, you know, speak Spanish who aren't being represented in these polls. And the same thing happened in 2010 where Ken Buck was leading right up until Election Day, and then Udall pulled it up by 11,000 votes. So there are some things that seem uncertain, but then again, Gardner is leading by pretty healthy margins in some of these polls. So it'll be really interesting to see what happens. It's a very close race.
Yeah. I'm looking at the Huffington Post poll tracker, which is really interesting, and their confidence of win is that Gardner, the probability is that Gardner will win with 61% of the time, which, sounds pretty good, but that means roll a dice, and that means 4 out of 10 times, according to this, like you said, healthy lead in some of the polls that Gardner has, Udall still wins in a lot of those situations. So I do think, it is interesting, and certainly it seems to me, at least, that out of all of this, maybe all of the Senate races, we'll actually get to another one, but out of a lot of the Senate races, Colorado has one of the most, has one of the largest spheres of uncertainty around what we're going to be going into on Election Day.
Right. Yeah. I don't feel comfortable putting money on this one way or the other right now.
If you were to be a betting person, you wouldn't feel comfortable.
I don't feel comfortable. So, and it's pretty wild. There's been a lot of criticisms saying that Senator Udall's campaign and the affiliated Democratic outside groups have focused too much on reproductive health, reproductive rights issues, and hitting Congressman Gardner on his still supporting federal personhood bill that would give fetuses full legal rights, even though he disavowed that sort of language at the state level. So that's been, you talk to Colorado voters and they're so sick of all the negative ads around that issue. There's been some questioning of whether the Udall campaign should have been highlighting earlier, because they've just started to do it, more of the senator's work in the Senate on NSA privacy issues. So I don't know if all of those things end up making a difference. It might ultimately, and a lot of stories are saying, it just comes down to the ground game. If Democrats are able to turn out voters who aren't being represented in these polls, suburban women living in the Arapahoe and Jefferson County outside of Denver, or if the momentum is really on Gardner's side, as it seems to be, and President Obama's really, really unpopular approval ratings in Colorado are ultimately what drags Senator Udall down.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Especially, you know, we have seen, at least, I haven't been to Colorado, so I haven't been doing some on-the-ground reporting, but in the national media, there is this meme, but news story that a lot of the campaign is focused on, like you said, reproductive health, women's issues, things like that. And you say that voters are saying they're kind of sick of the negative ads here, but historically, negative ads work. You know, according to the political science literature, they actually do work in turning this enthusiasm for or against a candidate. They work in turning out voters. So I'd be interested to see what we might have to rely on exit polls here, but what the gender gap might be in Colorado after all of these negative ads, which, like you said, a lot of the voters are saying they've grown kind of sick of.
Yeah, a lot of voters I talked to, actually, Governor John Hickenlooper, the Democrat there, runs only positive spots. And I mean, outside groups supporting him have started to run negative ads. And his opponent, former Congressman Bob Beaupre, has said, well, there are negative ads running against me. They're just not from you, and you should disavow those. But a lot of voters I talked to said, oh, I like that Hickenlooper guy. He runs positive spots. So I don't know if that was just the skewed sample of the people that I was bugging there. But negative ads work. But they also drag both candidates on favorability ratings down. And so I think everyone there is just like sick of everything. They want it to be over. So the best way for it to be over for them is if they just send their ballot in and then they'll stop being hassled. But yeah, with the reproductive rights stuff, I wonder if it's just that personhood is sort of a complicated thing and that it's kind of hard to understand. It's confusing, and Gardner has tried to weasel away from that and say that it's just a statement that he supports life. But then groups like the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, other reproductive rights advocacy groups, medical experts, American Medical Association say no, that kind of language would ban all forms of abortion and some forms of birth control, like intrauterine devices. So I think maybe it's possible that Gardner just hasn't made any crazy statements or extreme statements. He has that legislative record of supporting it, but he doesn't come across as someone who's really scary as a candidate or extreme. And so maybe it's just that's not getting across because his legislative record doesn't match with the way he comes across in person. And so it's kind of interesting. We'll see if the gender gap is big enough to put Senator Udall all over the top. It's looking like it might not be right now.
Yeah, Gardner, nice guy who comes across like he, you know, played football at your local high school.
Yes, he did play football. So,
that
was pretty silly.
Let's wrap this up. But quick, you're not a betting woman, but do you have a prediction on Colorado? Just any prediction here.
My prediction is that if Senator Udall wins, it's going to be super, super close, like a few thousand votes. But that's if he wins, and I'm so nervous about deciding where I come down on that. It'll be as of next week. I think we could make more of a prediction once more of the votes from Denver and Boulder come in, because right now a lot of the votes are from kind of the areas outside of the city, and so it's just too early to tell.
Yeah, I'm a big I believe in the power of the mail ballot and the power of incumbency. Uh-huh. So I'm gonna predict Udall's gonna pull this out.
There you go.
Not super confident. Again, watching as the ballots do come in, like you said, from some of the major metro areas, seeing, you know, what percentages of people are actually turning in those mail ballots will be really interesting. But let's move on. Next race I want to talk about is Wisconsin. So the governor's race. So Scott Walker is locked in a fairly tight battle with Democrat. Scott Walker, incumbent Republican, locked in a fairly tight battle with Democratic challenger Mary Burke. And, you know, this has, you know, kind of national implications. You know, us in D.C., people who focus on the Republican Party, you know, Scott Walker's kind of a dark horse for 2016. But if he loses in his gubernatorial reelection race, that puts a dent in kind of his political credibility. But what's interesting here, and Scott Walker was a huge target for a lot of left-wing movement interests in the past. You know, we had the Wisconsin recall elections, which Walker survived, and some of his Republican colleagues survived as well. His race in 2010 was fairly expensive, just kind of generally. And looking into this, I was surprised that he's not as large of a target this time around. Ad spending is actually pretty significantly down, despite Walker having a very credible challenger in Mary Burke. And a lot of those outside groups that we saw spending against Walker in the past haven't really put money into it this time, which surprised me because, like I said, I think that this is he's in a very vulnerable position this time around, a surprisingly vulnerable position. And while I said I'm a believer in the value of incumbency, it just, in general, I think that the geographic polarization of people make it really hard for a Republican to win and govern in what is, just fact of the matter, a blue state.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a few different things to pick up on. First, with why he hasn't been as much of a target, I think that my speculation is that the labor groups and other progressive groups are kind of following Mary Burke's lead because she hasn't been making what he did to the union groups in Wisconsin an issue. Like, she's been staying really far away from that stuff. And so it just doesn't look like the recall election, because she hasn't made it a central issue. She's really made it a referendum more on his promise that he would create, I think it was 250,000 jobs in his first term, and he fell 150,000 jobs short of that. And so she's made it more a referendum on the state's economic performance and hasn't gone after the labor stuff, which is interesting because it could really motivate people to the polls, you know, sort of turn out those kind of folks. But maybe she figures that they would be turning out anyway, and she's trying to win over a lot of the moderates, independents, who might be more inclined to vote for him. So I agree with you. It's like really kind of weird because it's just such a different election than when they were trying to recall him.
Yeah, that's, I mean, to a certain extent, it makes a lot of sense. You know, the economic climate in the Midwest is not great right now. And, you know, that's something that has actually worked in Republicans' favor in a lot of other races, that the economy still isn't fantastic. They blame Obama for that. They're trying to make it a national election. But it does make sense to say, you know, in Wisconsin, Scott Walker has not lived up to his promise of creating jobs, because a lot of people in Wisconsin are suffering because of that, because of the lackluster performance of Wisconsin's economy. But still, it seems like it would be something that would translate fairly easily into labor union issues, because, right, you know, labor unions are focused on economic issues,
right,
and a lot of people, and, you know, say what you want about the declining influence of labor unions in America, they're still fairly strong in the Midwest. They still have fairly strong networks. Mm-hmm. They have proven to be electoral forces. Even in, you know, the fact that the recall elections even happened was kind of a victory for labor unions the first time around.
Right.
So it's kind of surprising that Burke hasn't grasped on that in Wisconsin.
Yeah, she seems like, to me, a really cautious candidate. She's very on message when I've seen her at events and things like that. It's very focused, playing it very safe. And so maybe she just saw that as too incendiary or an issue, too inflammatory to go near it. It's pretty fascinating. And meanwhile, they've been hitting him on his record as a governor on reproductive rights issues, as they generally do in these sorts of states. And it seems to be working, because he actually had to release an ad saying, oh, I trust women, I just care about women's safety. He was like speaking directly into the camera. Interesting sort of ad. And clearly he wouldn't have done that unless he thought that he was vulnerable on the issue. And then he told Robert Costa, who's an amazing journalist with the Washington Post, in a story on One-on-One, he was saying, you know, this race is going to be really, really close. So he's not even projecting that sort of bravado of like, oh, I'm fine, I'm safe, people like me. He recognizes the stakes. She's managed to make it a really competitive race. The polls are really close.
Yeah, I mean, even I think it was a month or 2 months ago, when the race looked like it was tightening, I spoke to some people at the RNC who said they weren't particularly worried about what was going to happen in Wisconsin. And I'm not sure if, you know, they were just playing me as a journalist here, saying, don't worry, we've got this in the bag. Be confident about it. But it seemed like they genuinely were pretty positive on what the outcome was going to be. And this race, you know, the polling here is closer than it is in the last race we discussed in Colorado. They're generally within the margin of error, a lot of the polls here, either if they're predicting Walker or Burke. So it is a much closer race than I think anyone expected it to be, even a couple months ago.
Yeah, definitely.
And I'm like I said, a believer in the value of incumbency, but this is a closer race than the previous one we just discussed. So I'm not sure which way it's going to go.
And I wonder with voters if they're just like so fed up. This is the fourth time. It's the third time in 4 years that he's on the ballot. And I wonder if it becomes a fatigue thing where it's like, ugh, like over him, gonna vote him out. Or if it's a fatigue thing that they feel like he's managed to survive and so he's not going anywhere. It's interesting to see. It keeps on happening to these poor people over and over and over again that they have to face his ads and an opponent's ads trying to kick him out. So, oh man. So that would be exhausting for sure.
Yeah, I haven't read any literature on recall elections or closely timed elections or anything like that. You know, we see special elections where like a special election will happen in April, and then the person that wins that will be again on the ballot in November. So I wonder, yeah, you know, what the effect is of seeing election after election after election with the same candidate in a relatively short time span.
Yeah.
But again, like you said, that could go either way. It could be, I'm tired of seeing Scott Walker on my TV. Or it could be, I'm tired of the Democrats trying to get rid of Scott Walker. Why don't they just give up? Or something like that, you know?
Yeah. And I've been surprised by it. Like, the kind of attacks that Republicans have been leveling at Burke really look like what Democrats attack Republicans on. Like, they accused her through her bike company of outsourcing jobs abroad, yada, yada, yada. Like, it really, like, if you didn't know, if you blacked out, you didn't know who the people were running the ads, you would think it was Democrats running ads against a Republican, but it's the other way around. It looks exactly like what Democrats are trying to do to David Perdue in Georgia.
Yeah.
And so that's been kind of wild, too. Yeah.
I mean, I think the lesson there is that certain messages work no matter which party is behind them.
Uh-huh.
But let's move on. But first, do you have a prediction here? I'm going to predict Walker wins. He stays in office.
I think he's going to stay too, but it'll be close as well.
It will be very close. I feel like that might be the closest one of the races we're going to talk about today.
But I wonder if he wins, if he holds on, if people will criticize Burke's campaign for playing it too safe and for not motivating more Democrats. Because, look, it's a state where, like, Senator Tammy Baldwin can win, and she's super progressive. So maybe they'll figure that there might have been people who might have been more excited about Burke if she had played up more progressive messages.
There will be recriminations no matter who wins and on basically every topic. And the playing it
safe... Right, and does that hurt his presidential run? Narrative always comes into play. Yeah, and does that hurt his presidential run if he wins but only narrowly, or does it not matter because he can say, oh, I'm a Republican who won in a blue state, the same way that Governor Christie will say, oh, I'm a Republican who won in New Jersey.
Yeah.
Maybe. Yeah.
All right. So we're going to pick a couple upsets that didn't look like they would be upsets even a couple weeks ago. So do you want to give us your upset special prediction? Not prediction, but upset special, where we should be looking at the underdog here.
Yeah, my upset special is the New Hampshire Senate race, where Sky may have heard of him. He may have seen him serve in Congress before. Former Senator Scott Brown of Massachusetts is giving actually a really strong challenge to Senator Jean Shaheen in New Hampshire. And the reason that I would call this an upset is because this is the race where we'll really, if former Senator Brown wins, it's because there was a Republican wave, because New Hampshire voters are famously kind of fickle. If you Google, like, New Hampshire voters fickle, you'll actually find all these fun stories about this. But they really will go wherever the rest of the country is going. And so if they pick Brown, it's because Republicans are able to pick up more than six, like eight Senate seats. And if they don't, then it means that it's less of a Republican wave across the country. And so that's where you're seeing polling, actually. A poll yesterday had Shaheen up only at 2 points, and he's kind of gained on her as he's nationalized the race, made it about all these foreign policy issues, scared voters about Ebola and ISIS and undocumented immigrants coming into the country all at the same time. And so there she actually is looking a little bit more vulnerable than she had earlier in the cycle.
Yeah, it's a race that's mostly shocked me. But I'm someone, you know, I've moved all around, so I don't really have a home state or a home constituency or district or anything like that. And I mean, maybe it's just a product of that, but the idea of the carpetbagger politician just shocks me. Just those that,
yeah,
like someone who can say, oh, that guy was, you know, literally right next door a year or 2 years ago, he just came here and I'm going to vote for him because he's going to represent me. And maybe it's the case that representation and proximity of culture to representation doesn't matter anymore. And we might be seeing that in New Hampshire, but I don't know. It just seems so politically craven to me that it's very surprising that these race, this race particularly, can be so close, considering how recently Scott Brown was a senator from Massachusetts. So yeah, that very much surprises me. And like you said, it could just be a product of the Republican wave, and that New Hampshire voters just say, and that this has been such a nationalized election that it's literally just red versus blue, and it doesn't matter that it's Gene Shaheen and Scott Brown, it just matters that it's red and blue, and they're voting for red.
I think that's what if she loses, that's what it'll be, because she's very well known, she's a former governor, her ratings are pretty high, like, she doesn't have super low approval ratings. It'll really end up being, if she loses, it's because President Obama dragged her down, and Brown was able to make the race about a bunch of other things other than her. And then in terms of the New Hampshire, Massachusetts thing, I was confused about this as well and talked to some people from that area, and they said that it's the same media market. You know, people in New Hampshire are watching Boston TV. They just sort of maybe perhaps the border between or the boundary between the two states is a little bit more fluid than that. But that to me is like crazy. And Shaheen had a good line about that in their last debate a few days ago, where she said, you know, I don't see New Hampshire as a consolation prize, you know.
Yeah, I remember.
Look at you.
That
you
was
lost
a good
in
line.
Massachusetts. Yeah, that was a really good line. And so yeah, she said it at another point of the debate. She said, you know, if I lose, she was being very frank ultimately, and said it's because of factors outside of my control. So it's pretty wild to see that happening in New Hampshire. Yeah.
But New Hampshire, I will say, and we have to note, is a anomaly among New England states. They're much redder, or, you know, the live free or die ethos is very powerful in that state. And mm-hmm. It doesn't necessarily make them quote unquote Republicans, but it makes them more libertarian-ish. And you see that pretty consistently in their culture, which is, why I thought that, like you said, the border fluidity and the culture fluidity thing is a little surprising to me, because New Hampshire has always seemed to me to be a particularly, you know, homely, patriotic state. You know, they're very about New Hampshire itself and the, you might say the borders, of New Hampshire, but it makes sense. The media market explanation makes a lot of sense, because, you know, I live in mm-hmm. D.C. I see political candidates running in Virginia and Maryland. I feel like they're almost running in my state because the TV ads are all the same. You know,
except
actually,
we're also kind of jealous because we don't have any Senate races or governor's races to get into.
Yeah.
Because we have no rights. So that's a whole separate issue.
Well,
but and that's why I think the libertarian impulses make her attacks on his record on reproductive rights issues particularly potent. You know, she can criticize him for being a supporter of the Blunt Amendment, which would, before Hobby Lobby, whole thing on the Affordable Care Act, saying that employers could deny insurance coverage for birth control, not just for religious reasons, but for moral reasons as well. And so she's been hitting him for that and for his support for Hobby Lobby. And so I feel like in a state like that, that's particularly effective. Especially with an all-women congressional delegation and governor, so women governor, two women representatives, two women senators, to be able to say, hey, you know, Scott Brown thinks that your employer should be able to dictate what kind of health care that you receive. And so you see her gender gap is pretty big, like 10 points or more. And so I think if she wins, it'll be partially because she's able to blow that up to be pretty massive.
I would be interested to see how that breaks down, because, and this is just kind of an intra-libertarian-ish fight, but that's something that divides the left libertarians and the right libertarians.
Mm-hmm.
Like, most libertarians generally support, are pro, you would characterize them as pro-choice, but they're also very pro-business and pro not having the government tell you how to run your business. So that's something that I've seen, at least, a lot of, you know, movement and intellectual libertarians be on the Hobby Lobby side rather than on the reproductive rights side in that particular case. But it could be that in New Hampshire, the kind of left reproductive rights impulse is a lot stronger than the pro-business impulse in that case.
Right. That's actually something really interesting to look at, given how fiercely independent these people are. And New Hampshire voters are smart. They're bugged all the time by everyone. Everyone wants them.
Right.
They're so highly desired. So I feel like these people are very discerning. And so we'll see if they're skeptical of Scott Brown's genuineness. as he runs there.
Yeah, yeah. So you think that this is an upset pick? You think that Scott Brown is going to win?
I could see him winning. If all the other races continue to trend towards the GOP. So if they're picking up Alaska, they're picking up Louisiana. Arkansas seems to be in the bag. Montana, South Dakota, all those places, plus Iowa and Colorado, they're getting New Hampshire. And so that would be one. You're going to force me to pick again, but I think he could win. So
I think Shaheen's going to win this one. I think it would be, like you said, if it turns into this, like, not literal, figurative tidal wave for Republicans, uh-huh. Scott Brown has a chance, but it just seems so out of the box here to me. And considering Shaheen was leading by double digits a couple months ago, it seems just shocking that this could be that close. But, you know, We'll see. I think she'll pull it out.
Gotcha.
Lastly, my upset pick, and I'm not even sure that this is an upset pick anymore, according to the polls, but Kansas, in the Kansas Senate race, I think Greg Orman, who is an independent, is going to beat incumbent Senator Pat Roberts. And until I'm not entirely sure when the initial push happened, but this was a three-way race a couple months ago with the Democrat, I don't even remember his name, versus Greg Orman.
Chad Taylor.
Yes, Taylor, thank you. Chad Taylor, Greg Orman, the independent, and incumbent Senator Pat Roberts. And this was not a race on anyone's radar until Chad Taylor pulled out of the race. And that led a lot of the Democratic support, well, basically all of the Democratic support for Taylor swinging into Orman's column and actually giving him, until recently, a fairly consistent lead in the polls. So basically this race has broken down to independent Greg Orman, who actually was running for the Democratic nomination in 2008 in this very race before pulling out and running in an independent this election cycle, and Pat Roberts. Now, Greg Orman, what's interesting to me, and I've been covering this race, is that in 2008, Pat Roberts won the self-identified independent vote in Kansas by 5 points. In 2012, Mitt Romney won the self-identified independent vote in Kansas by 8 or 9 points. This time around, Greg Orman is winning the self-identified independent vote in Kansas by 25 points. And that gap right there is the entire reason why Orman is leading in this race. And, well, at least that was according to the latest poll. I've seen that swing wildly. But the independent vote in Kansas, self-identified independent vote, is larger than the Democratic vote in Kansas. So that is basically why Greg Orman has been able to make this a race. And Pat Roberts has been hammering Orman on, you know, saying that he's not an independent, he's a Democrat with an I next to his name, and that's the only difference between him and, you know, Chad Taylor. And Greg Orman has done his best to not really stake out positions on some hot-button issues that Roberts has been trying to pin him down on. But, you know, that independent gap for Orman has been pretty steady. It looked like it was closing for a while, but then a couple polls recently showed him still handily winning that. So I think it's going to be an incredibly close race. I'm not even sure the whole turnout thing matters here, because it seems like, and again, because of the self-identified partisan polling on this, it just seems like that I next to Greg Orman's name is making all the difference in the race.
Mm-hmm. And that I plus people in the Republican primary, so many conservatives were upset with him. He beat Milton Wolf by not that much, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
And also all the stories about him not actually owning a home in Kansas, being this creature of Washington, you know, longtime senator who made the people, I mean, people hit him on it, but I think he was joking, but it was kind of still revealing. He said, you know, oh, I'm home every time I get an opponent. So people also, I mean, he's also managed, I think, to piss off a lot of Republicans too, who were tuned into the primary when all that stuff was going down.
That's absolutely true.
But I wrote a piece of yours.
A lot of the
Yeah, I wrote a piece of you.
I think a lot of the attacks on Roberts from the primary have carried over into the general election. And actually, the Secretary of State in Kansas, tried to make it illegal for the Democrat to pull out of the race so late. And it was ruled against him. So it's only been a two-man race for essentially a month at this point. And when polling opened, the initial polls had Orman up by like 10 points on Roberts. And that gap has closed a lot. And it's closed mostly because Roberts has been able to convince Republicans to come and vote for Roberts. The amount of Republicans that Orman was pulling in the beginning was fairly large. Recent polling have shown the split to be Roberts went from having like 65% of the self-identified Republican vote to 80% of the Republican vote, and that basically closed the gap.
Right.
So Roberts still needs to make up that difference with actual Republicans, and he actually had a huge problem with Milton Wolf, who has refused to endorse Roberts in the general after, you know, that race became pretty bitter by the end. And Wolf is not, you know, he's not necessarily an Orman guy, but he is not a Roberts fan.
Right. Yeah, it's like kind of wild. I highly encourage anyone watching this, to check out a story that one of our reporters in our office, Elliot Nelson, wrote. He was in Kansas last week, and he wrote a story about the Republicans/independents in Kansas and how upset they are in the governor's race. And I really wonder what the impact of that governor's race will be, because it looks like the Democrat Paul Davis is going to beat Governor Sam Brownback. And so there could be a lot of Republicans who are turning out who are really upset with Governor Brownback over the tax cuts and funding for education, who feel like Brownback just went too far to the right, who may be turning out to vote for Brownback and then also put Roberts in the same category. And so I wonder about that as well. There's like a lot of different complicating, weird partisan cross currents happening in this state.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of strange things because the Roberts Republican demographic and the Brownback Republican demographic are really different, bases of the Republican Party. And they don't, they're not particularly friendly with each other. So it'll be interesting to see how those, like you said, those two effects kind of clash once you get those people to the polls. But prediction time, I'm going to say Orman's going to win this in a, you know, result that was unthinkable a couple months ago, but now has looked it's looked less likely in the last few weeks, but looked to be very likely about a month ago.
I think Roberts is going to get reelected. And I think that might be because the heavy spending against Orman that's finally gotten up on TV. They brought out some really smart Republican operatives. The Swift Boat guy, Chris LaCivita, who's very smart and well-known in Republican circles. They brought him out. They've kind of resurrected his campaign. Formerly, didn't look like it was alive, and now it does. And I think that there might be a lot of Republicans in the state who don't trust Orman, don't get a good handle on who he is, aren't convinced that he's really an independent, as you were saying. And also, you're seeing people saying, what's your position on abortion? And he seems to be in favor of reproductive rights and stuff like that. And so I think that ultimately that skepticism won't work for him. And I think Senator Roberts is going to be okay, actually.
Yeah, I mean, to defend Roberts, you know, again, 2-3 months ago, it didn't look like he needed a ground game in Kansas. And now that it's happened, he has been ramping up the operation. And, you know, Republican operatives themselves, like you said, have been rushing to try and help him out. So it could be the case that he just needed a little bit of time to get back into, you know, real campaign mode.
Yeah, and he's pulled out all the stops. Like, he's having every big name Republican, Ted Cruz, every big name person is coming out to help him. And so I think as voters finally start to tune in there to the race and start to pay attention in the last couple of weeks, I think he'll pull it out.
Yeah. We're almost out of time here, but quick before we go, thoughts on, like we've talked about a little bit here, the wave and how big or small it might be for Republicans nationally.
Sure. Well, the crazy scenario that's my favorite is where Republicans, I wrote this down because I'm incompetent at math. Republicans pick up 5 seats And Democrats have, so it's 47-50, but then you have three independents. If you have Orman win under your model, and then you have Senator Bernie Sanders and Angus King who are already there, so you have a 50-50 split, and then the vice president has to break ties. So that's, like, right. The most wild one that maybe isn't likely, but it doesn't seem like to be, like, too unlikely. And so that's one that could be, like, really, really wild. But I think more likely that it ends up being Republicans pick up. They need six. They need to net six. And I think that they probably, if I had to give my answer, like, where you nail me down, I'm going to say they're going to pick up, like, seven.
Yeah, I think it's very close. And it's probably in that six to seven range for Republicans. What's interesting in that three independents model is that both Angus King and Orman have said, I believe that they've said, that they're going to caucus with whichever party controls the Senate. And it's mm-hmm. interesting if it actually comes down to who they caucus with to who controls the Senate.
And then it comes down to how they really feel, like, what's going to let them sleep at night, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And Angus King, when he won last time, said that he was going to come to Washington, listen to what both parties had to say or offer him or whatever. But everyone pretty much thought that he was going to caucus with Democrats, and he did.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems hard to imagine a scenario where even when if the Republicans have control of the Senate, either King or Orman caucuses with them, because they're, I mean, obviously Orman is playing a spoiler in Kansas, but their independent nature at this moment means that they're upsetting Republicans and making Democrats actually happy. And when mm-hmm. that happens, it all, what your, you know, committee assignment is, matters a lot. And in almost any scenario where Orman wins, but Republicans win the Senate and Orman caucuses with Republicans, they're going to give him the worst assignments. They're not going to like that guy. I can't imagine either of them really caucusing with Republicans in any scenario.
Yeah, they're putting him on the committee that no one wants to be on. Exactly. Yeah, for sure. And let's be honest, like, we were following that whole drama before Taylor dropped out very closely. And I wrote a story about it, actually, mm-hmm. and contacted a very high-level Democratic person and said, you know, are you asking Taylor to drop out of the race? And they didn't say yes or no, but it was kind of like not, you know. So it seems
the non-denial denial.
Yeah, exactly. And so we'll see. But I think that's the crazy scenario. So the more likely one is Republicans win in South Dakota, Montana, West Virginia, Arkansas, Louisiana, and Alaska. And they have six. And then I think they're going to win in Iowa. And so that's seven. Mm-hmm. And so the only way Democrats can complicate that is if Michelle Nunn wins in Georgia.
Yeah.
And she would have to win outright in November without it going to a runoff. She'd have to get at least 50% of the vote there. And so that maybe that complicates things. That doesn't look to be out of the question. But it's really like, this is really a nail biting kind of whole wild thing. Lots of different wild scenarios that seem actually kind of possible.
All right. Well, that's about all the time we have for today. Thanks a lot for joining me.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
And I'll see everyone next time on Blogging Heads.